Okay, let's begin. We're slightly past 6:30. A very good evening to you. My name's Tony Travers. I'm based in the government department here at the London School of Economics. Welcome to those of you who are from outside, and also, of course, to those of you who are from within. This evening's event is really to hear from Professor Andrew Gamble about his new book, Can the Welfare State Survive? There is a small pile on a nice table outside, which I'm sure are available to purchase at the remarkably good price. I can't see on the back anyway. It's terribly good value. And Andrew, I'm sure, will sign copies of that afterwards. So when we finish, possible to go out. If you want to buy one, come in, and I'm sure Andrew will sign it. Andrew is Professor of Politics at the University of Cambridge, previously having for many years been at the University of Sheffield. He was awarded the Isaiah Berlin Prize by the Political Studies Association for his lifetime contribution to political studies. And he's going to talk this evening about the book, which is provocatively called Can the Welfare State Survive? And if I can just leap ahead to one of the final chapters where it says the future for the welfare state, which begins, faced with all these challenges, can the welfare state survive? It has to change if it is to do so. That is nothing new. It's been changing throughout the last 100 years. But its survival is not guaranteed. And just thinking about this this evening, and the book covers not only the UK, but makes a number of compares the progress of the welfare state, not only in Britain, but also looks at other countries. The issue, it seems to me, is that we've seen continuous growth in welfare states, certainly since 1945, but up to a point where taxpayers and the capacity to fund the state has bumped into the capacity to raise taxes. And so what we've seen is not only that problem, but the competition between states for taxation growing as well. So states are now competing with each other in a way that wasn't so true in the past, and often cutting taxes to do that, and certainly cutting corporation and other business taxes to do that. Whereas welfare states have to some extent got tangled up with welfare states have got tangled up with consumerism. People expect states to reflect their quality of life, while at the same time, those same people want to sustain their own personal incomes and spend them on other forms of consumerism. And welfare states and governments that determine their size and tax revenues have to balance all of that out. Anyway, that's enough from me. That was just a few night thoughts. Andrew's going to speak for 40 minutes. Then we can have a open it out for questions, and we'll sort of finish certainly by 8 o'clock, if not a little before. Andrew.
Okay, well, thanks, Tony, and thanks very much for the invitation, and it's always a great pleasure to be here at LSE. So, can the welfare state survive? The argument of the book is really that the welfare state is facing a battle for survival, and yet there's an immediate paradox about the welfare state, that the richer societies become, the less able and less willing they are to fund their welfare states. And yet the welfare state, on any measure, is one of the great achievements of the last 100 years, one of the great political achievements, and it's actually a badge of success, of maturity, of a society. It was one of the principal means for the reconciling of democracy and capitalism. And yet, it's not a new thing, the worries about the welfare state. We go back to the 1970s. Ever since the 1970s, we've had the welfare state has suffered almost a perpetual austerity, a fiscal crisis, problems about underfunding, anxieties about rising entitlements, rising costs, and about the quality of public services. And this has led to constant restructuring of the welfare state, constant reorganization, the search for efficiencies. And it seems we never let the welfare state alone. We're always tinkering. We're always trying to do new things to it. And so the One of the questions which arises amidst all this is, do we still need welfare states? Do we need welfare, but do we need the state to actually provide welfare? And of course there is a line of argument which will be very familiar to all of you, which has now quite a long pedigree, and it argues really that welfare states belong with socialism, trade unions, collectivism, planning to an earlier era, and that and the one of the contemporary leitmotifs of our politics is that individuals should be free to make their own choices about the services they use and pay for the quality they want. The state should not interfere in these choices or tell individuals what they should do. The state has no more need to be providing welfare, or indeed health, education, pension, social security, than it has to be providing steel. Of course, it's not doing very much providing of steel these days.
It is increasingly providing steel.
Well, actually it is, yes. It's going back to it. So the argument is, however much the welfare state may have been justified in the past, it is no longer needed in today's economy. It's become positively harmful, a major drag upon prosperity and growth, because it is inherently wasteful and inefficient and requires high levels of taxation to fund it. It's also been claimed that welfare states are the last bastion of command economies. That's when the EU isn't being said that that's the last bastion. That it leads to misallocation of resources, there's no proper market discipline, no budget constraints. So the welfare state in this kind of perspective appears as a giant parasite sucking the life out of the private sector, an insatiable appetite for additional resources. One of the books which first made some of these claims was by two economists in the 1970s, Roger Bacon and Walter Eltis, called Too Few Producers, and arguing that the welfare state had become a burden which the private sector, again, it was a period of austerity in the 1970s, the private sector could no longer support. And partly the argument also was that there'd been a retreat from the original insurance principle that had inspired the original welfare state, and welfare was now funded largely from general taxation. But this was the problem: the ever-increasing costs and demands and entitlements, and ever-increasing demand, therefore, for more funding. And the more apocalyptic writers in this vein argue, and of course still argue, particularly at the moment in the United States, argue that the end of this spiral will be fiscal crisis and the collapse of the public finances. And they see the problem also is that welfare has become politicized, that claimants and public sector employers push their special interests. And so the welfare state is a sort of serpent whose coils have fastened round the private entrepreneurial economy and are squeezing it to death. And at the same time, they are infantilizing the poor and making the poor dependent and taking away their independence with harmful consequences. And in a way, the last few decades, the politics of the welfare state has very much formed around special interests and parties which want to see increases in spending or maintain existing levels of spending, and coalitions against welfare with their attacks on welfare dependency. And Tony mentioned in his opening remarks about the new consumerism, the idea that we should contract for welfare like any other service and pay, as a result, then pay lower taxes. And we could privatize health, privatize education, privatize pensions even more than we've already done. And if we were to do all those things, then we might be able to bring expectations back into line with resources. Although if you look at the cost of of insurance, private health insurance in the United States, and it wouldn't actually suggest that that is very likely. But it would at least restore a free economy and a minimal state, maximize choice and quality of services. And one of the interesting crossovers in this is that many of these themes, which of course are associated with the neoliberal right of British politics, many of them were echoed in the 1970s by the New Left, who talked about the contradictions of the welfare state, the conflict between legitimation and accumulation, and attacked what was seen as the paternalism of the welfare state, the stigmatizing of claimants, and in more contemporary Foucauldian language, the disciplining of claimants and the gendered politics which was said to the welfare state involved. So these arguments have been made for a long time on both sides of the political spectrum, and yet the welfare state continues to exist. So there has been an enormous ideological barrage against the welfare state. Many of its supporters have not really stood up very strongly to defend it. It's a bit rather like the EU. A lot of people sort of defend the welfare state reluctantly as something that exists and that we rather not do without. And all the passion, ideological passion, appears to be on the other side. One of the current period we're in is a period of, again, of austerity, of fiscal retrenchment, a major new squeeze on the welfare state. The recovery is very weak. It's taking a very long time to get established. These are very different times, even than the 1970s, in which we can't see as yet any clear prospect of the kind of growth which we've been used to at various periods in the post-war period actually returning. And so it's not surprising that in this climate there are radical plans to reduce the size of the state. There were fears expressed before the last election about the plans which some saw in George Osborne to return spending to 1930s levels. I don't think that was ever very serious, but certainly the ambition to shrink the size of government has been there in the coalition. And if you cross the Atlantic, the Paul Ryan plan, I mean, Paul Ryan is not in the best of odor with the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party at the moment, but Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House and former vice presidential nominee for his party, he launched the Ryan plan, which was a very ambitious plan for the contraction of federal spending down to between 15% and 20% of US GDP, which would have been a very substantial reduction, and as analysts pointed out, would have left almost nothing for all the other activities of US government. So that was a fairly mainstream proposal within the Republican Party. And yet, despite all this, I want to argue tonight, and I argue in the book, that the position of the welfare state is a lot stronger than it might appear. I argue that there's still a broad coalition in most countries, a broad coalition of support for welfare services which are universal and free at the point of use. And I also argue that that capitalism needs the welfare state as much as the welfare state needs capitalism. It's very difficult to think of how we could run our modern economy unless we, without the welfare state. There is a mutual dependence which has grown up. And The image of the welfare state as a parasite seems to me hugely overblown. And I think we can see why that's so by thinking a little bit about the historical complexity of the welfare state. The welfare state isn't just one thing. It's grown organically in lots of very interesting ways. It's far from being a rationalist blueprint which was imposed at one particular point. There have been projects of both the right and the left in British politics which built the welfare state. And some of the most important ones at the inception of the welfare state came from the political right. Welfare programs, a means to incorporate the labour movement, to actually blunt some of the force of the anti-capitalist movements that existed in the early decades of the 20th century and the late 19th, and to moderate some of the extremes of inequality. And this was then taken up by parties and movements of the left. There was a moral response in across the political spectrum to the plight of the working poor. There was a political response to the rise of radical working class movements, and there was a pragmatic response because of the need in, as industrial societies developed, a need to provide healthier and better educated citizens and workers in this new world. And it led to the new collectivism of the 20th century, which was all about nation building and common citizenship, communities of fate and democratic legitimacy and fairness. And the projects of parties of the left and centre-left built on the limited welfare states which had come into being and extended them and developed the universal element of them, the universal programmes. And in the 1950s, these were often hailed as the secret of this new democratic capitalism, this new dispensation, this new settlement, which had resolved some of the worst of the conflicts of the earlier period. And I think that that history is very easily lost and forgotten or neglected. It's important to remember that Bismarck and Joseph Chamberlain were great champions of the welfare state. Joseph Chamberlain, the liberal unionist and then conservative unionist statesman, he said the welfare state was the ransom that property had to pay to be secure. Politicians were quite blunt in those days. And so he had no problems about... He was a big industrialist in Birmingham originally. He had no problems about seeing the need for pensions, for unemployment relief and the rest, for reducing insecurity, for providing basic risk protection. And the need too of the industrial economy, as I've said, for healthier and better educated workers with more disposable income, the reaction, again, quite broadly across the political spectrum to the self-regulating market. And then in the 1930s, the discrediting of political liberalism and of what remained of, let's say, fair economic doctrines and the strong individualist currents of the 19th century following the Wall Street crash and the Great Depression. There was a widespread recognition that capitalism needed to be fundamentally reorganized to provide a basic minimum of security and income to every citizen. And in the UK, the famous Beveridge Report, with its in the Second World War, with its identification of the five giants of want, idleness, disease, ignorance, and squalor. I mean, that set the template for post-war politics in the UK, but it was something which was being echoed, which was subsequently echoed in many countries across Europe. And these universal programs of social security, of health, of education and housing, funded through higher levels of taxation, this became the formula for not just politics of the left, but a politics of the right as well in the 1950s. One of my favorite quotations, which is by Rab Butler, who was a Conservative Chancellor of the Exchequer and at in the 1950s, and at the Conservative Party conference in either 1953 or, I think 1953, he said, those people, this was to a Conservative Party conference, he said, those people who talk about creating pools of unemployment should be thrown into them and made to swim. This is not a sentiment that Conservative Chancellor Exchequer have frequently come out with in more recent decades. Now, the as I said before, in the 1950s and 1960s, the assumption became quite widespread that the secret of stable and prosperous democratic capitalism had been discovered. But this did prove temporary, and the long crisis of the 1970s, the welfare state at that time became a major target of attack, a problem which threatened prosperity rather than sustaining it. And this has led to quite a wide variation of responses. There's been a growing divergence in welfare states and welfare state models across Europe, captured by Esping Anderson in 1990 with his Three Worlds of Welfare Capitalism. And the divergence between the Nordic welfare states with their generous provisions funded by high taxation and decommodification of public services on the one hand, and at the other extreme, the Anglo-American or Anglo-Saxon models moving more towards residual welfare states based on the definition of welfare states as being primarily concerned with welfare and income support rather than with universal programs and social investment, human capital, and so on. But even in the residual welfare states, there were programs to combat insecurity arising in the life cycle or the labor market, and important universal programs like the National Health Service itself. So and what also political scientists observed in the 1990s was that despite all the radical rhetoric that came out of the 1980s of the particularly of the Anglo-American governments like the Thatcher government in the UK and the Reagan administration in the United States, Paul Pearson pointed out in a famous book that despite a great deal of reshaping of welfare states, radical right governments had distinct lack of success in actually rolling back the state. And he gave a very interesting political science explanation in terms of institutional resistance and institutional inertia for why that was the case, but he showed how the political support for welfare states was actually very difficult to dislodge when it came down to the practicalities. But that didn't mean that there wasn't a great deal of change in these years. The new public management, development of quasi-markets and targets and the audit culture and everything else with which we have all become all too familiar, that these were all introduced in bids to manage the public sector in new ways and to try and improve efficiencies and the trade-offs and to limit the escalation of costs. And many critics argue that the risk protection that the welfare state used to provide has been reduced. But there is a huge academic literature around these questions. I suppose more troubling is that over time there is some evidence of a long-term erosion of support for the welfare state, particularly for non-universal benefits such as Social Security. And particularly in this period of austerity and retrenchment, we have seen a lot of old stigmas revived. Language like strivers against shirkers, makers against takers, benefit cheats, benefit tourists, all of which go back to the famous distinction in the 19th century between the deserving and the undeserving poor. And there has been some undermining of older senses of solidarity and common purpose. And yet the basics of welfare states have not really changed. And the majority still of citizens still support core universal programs. And these social stability and legitimacy which these provide. So that the welfare state remains under threat because of the changes since the 2008 crash. And I think one of the problems that one of the things I try and do in the book is look at the nature of the challenges which the welfare state is having to confront now. And there are lots of challenges you could take, and I take four challenges, and some people have said to me, well, actually, you haven't divided them up quite right. But it's a way of at least getting a discussion going. The challenges are moral challenges, they're political challenges, they're economic challenges. The first one I discuss is affordability, which goes back to what Tony was saying at the beginning. It's the gulf between what people will pay in taxes and the services they expect. It's what people used to say, you know, the trouble with voters in modern democracies is they want Swedish-style public services and US-style taxes. And that's a bit difficult for any government to try and deliver both of those at the same time. There's also been a marked growth of tax resistance to paying higher taxes, which politicians now compete to promise that they won't raise particular taxes, tying their hands in ways which then sometimes comes back to bite them, and which most previous chancellors are very surprised that this is done. But the present Chancellor of the Exchequer in the UK is doing this all the time. At the same time, we see there's been a certain shrinking of the tax base in certain areas with the growth of tax avoidance and tax evasion, particularly by companies and the rich. And there have been campaigns for flat taxes and for residual welfare states and the ruling out of tax rises. And on the other side, we've got a rising tide of entitlements and expectations, rising costs in the public sector, open-ended universal benefits and the cost of health treatments and of pensions continually rising. And it's not... So the affordability crisis is a real crisis which underpins a lot of the problems which welfare states are currently facing. Then there's competitiveness, which is... This is the challenge which comes about through globalization and through the last few decades of increasing free trade, the weakening of organized labor, the end of full employment. And out of this has come an anxiety about a race to the bottom, about how do you preserve labor standards and welfare standards in a globalizing world? How do you... what do you do about growing immigration, which is very attractive to employers, but often can have serious effects upon domestic labour? And the welfare states in these circumstances can come to seem an extra layer of cost, which companies don't necessarily have to bear if they can relocate. And I suppose the wider issue which the competitiveness challenge creates is that the higher wages, the higher standards of living, the higher welfare which citizens of the of Europe and other advanced democracies have enjoyed for so long can appear in a globalizing world to be so many economic rents, to be so many privileges which could, under certain circumstances, be stripped away. The third challenge is the new social risks which so much of modern welfare state policy and literature is concerned. This is the new patterns of work, the new patterns of households which have grown up in the last few decades, the switch from manufacturing to services, the growth of financialization, the treatment of all citizens as autonomous financial agents, increasing the amount of debt they carry as individuals to navigate the life cycle, the increase in women's participation rate in the workforce, the growth of single parents, workless households, all the literature around the precariat, and the growth of social care for the elderly. We have trends towards a more individualist society and political culture, and the weakening of many of the institutions which in the past nurtured solidarity, such as trade unions and churches and extended families and large factories and working class communities. And some people have linked some of those trends with the hardening of attitudes to the poor and the reduction of support for redistribution. And then the fourth of my challenges, the demographic, which is to do with the change in the democratic profile of so many of the advanced democracies and the decline in mortality, increase in life expectancy, and the redistribution of young to old across the generations, with a relative reduction in the number working and paying taxes. And many of the solutions, I mean, they're all solutions to all these problems, but often they involve difficult political trade-offs. So it's how far can the retirement age be pushed back? How willing are countries that have an aging population to accept immigrants to bolster their working age populations? What measures could be put in place to raise birth rates? So finally, let me wrap this up by going back to my question, can the welfare state survive? Joseph Schumpeter wrote a book, Capitalism, Socialism and Democracy, in which there's a section of it where he says, can capitalism survive? No, I do not think it can. Well, I think he was wrong about that, or at least wrong in parts about the particular kind of prediction he was making. I mean, I want to argue that the welfare state can survive, but I do think there's no inevitability about it. There's nothing irreversible about the welfare state. There's no absolute guarantees. There are, as I've said, a set of moral and political challenges. If the welfare state is to survive, we have to find a way of renewing the social contract which underpins it and which gave rise to it in the first place. The whole question of taxation and what level taxation should be and what level of taxes people are prepared to pay in return for public services and the pooling of risks, those are the questions that have to be honestly debated. Without a sense of community and solidarity, the welfare state will not survive. So these are the choices that are going to have to be made. And certainly the growth in inequality and social fragmentation, which we see afflicting many of our societies at the present time, that makes it more difficult to put the cases for solidarity. Much easier to do it in the aftermath of a Second World War when there'd been a spirit of national unity and burden sharing. But I think also it's important not to be too pessimistic and gloomy, because as I've said earlier in this talk, we can turn the question round. It's not just can the welfare state survive, but it's can capitalism survive without the welfare state, and in particular, can democracies survive if the welfare, if we cannot have welfare states, and if we cannot have a welfare state which in certain respects is decommodified in Esping Anderson's sense, and in which social rights are given precedence over market performance. The reasons to be cheerful are that some battles are being won. I mean, Obamacare is from a European perspective, is a rather small step, but it is a step that was finally achieved, and although it still has problems, the longer that Obamacare lasts, it creates new entitlements and new interests and therefore makes it hard to unwind, just as Medicare is a very difficult program for Republican administrations to unwind. And another reason to be cheerful is that there are always new directions and new possibilities for the welfare state. There are new visions of democratic citizenship, and at the end of the book I briefly discuss ideas about basic income and capital grants. And it's not that any of these are panaceas, but I think that one of the things that advocates of the welfare state need is a way of explaining how the welfare state actually can promote self-reliance and independence and solidarity, can redistribute across the life cycle. But of course, all these ideas will not be sufficient on their own. A welfare state isn't just about helping individuals to adjust to circumstances and opportunities, but as Colin Crouch has argued, they also need to actively shape those circumstances and opportunities. And that means there is a role for the state in regulating labor markets, for thinking again about full employment, for regulating financial markets, for regulating housing, which is such a huge issue, which goes to the heart of so many welfare state issues, and regulating companies. And I think my final thought, though, is to say this, that I think the welfare state can be renewed, but ultimately it does rest upon a particular moral judgment about the sort of society that that we want to live in. And it's the idea that not every individual benefits equally from the welfare state, but all benefit from living in a society where every individual enjoys a basic security and opportunity to live a full life. And that's the promise of the welfare state, and that's what we might find we lost if we were to lose it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Perhaps just to start us off, you said towards the end, Andrew, you mentioned the self-evident fragmentation of society, that in a sense, you know, there are more than two political parties, people can watch more than two, or indeed one, or indeed no television or radio station, listen to radio stations. That in a whole range of ways, the social media, new media, have allowed people to become arguably more atomized, and certainly to pursue their own interests in a more fragmented way. I mean, you use the word fragmentation. And at some level, the state responds to that. I mean, it's interesting that the parts of the state that are most protected are pensions, which are a direct universal transfer to an articulate group, but they are a transfer of an amount of money per week. In-work benefits, which were also seen as okay by, you know, more than half of the MPs, have lived on. But beyond that, we've seen a move to voucher-based public services. So, in a sense, whether you go to a school or to a hospital, in a sense, you're carrying money through with you into the service. And a lot of academics, not only on the right, have argued for that as a way of actually driving, you know, Julian Legrand in particular here, driving the quality of public services. And then, you know, so you've got that sort of almost meeting, that explicit way of, I know pensions are not new, but actually the primacy given to them is new. So that sort of trying to tie the welfare system more to individuals and their needs, leaving a residual, which is basic provision of defence, policing and fire, so basic provision of the minimal state, then whatever's left. Now, is this a configuration or a characterization that makes sense? That in a sense, the welfare state is trying to respond to the fragmentation, through the medium of politics?
Yes. Well, I think the old style welfare state didn't actually. At a certain point, it no longer actually was providing services of the quality which people wanted. Mm-hmm. And I think that there was undoubtedly a big need for change and reorganization. But I think the critical thing always has been the. There are many ways you can experiment with delivering public services. Mm. But the critical thing, if you want to maintain a welfare state, is that you still it's still the state which shapes the pooling of the resources across the life cycle, and is therefore involved in that sort of redistribution, even if you didn't want to go into fiscal redistribution or income redistribution as well. And I think that what's... I suppose the challenge is how you preserve... how you would because some of the people who advocated vouchers, I mean, not Julian Legrand, but some people who advocated them, advocated them because they wanted them as a stepping stone to actually eventually saying to almost all citizens, you're on your own now, you take out your own insurance, the state will only look after only those that small minority of citizens who really can't look after themselves. And I think I think the big challenge of welfare state reform is finding ways where you do preserve, you maintain high quality of services, but you do give people the extra amount of choice and flexibility which they require. So it's you see it very clearly in the in the National Health Service that the very sort of heavy paternalism of the old National Health Service is increasingly has jarred with this more individualist, consumerist culture that we have. And I think there are ways of reconciling the two and still keeping the basic structures of the welfare state in being.
And of course, the single most popular indicator of the welfare state was always pretty fragmented and individualistic and effectively in the private sector, and that was GPs, of course. They were always... They've always been... Anyway... Yeah. George Jones. Oh, the microphone is coming. Can you bring up?
Two quick points.
Can you bring it round, Martin?
When you consider the history of the welfare state, you haven't mentioned the importance of war, as there is the stream of thought that what motivated the creation of our welfare state weren't humanitarian feelings or feelings of warm community, they were war. And Bismarck showed the way. His Prussian state is often presented as the creator of welfare programs. And the shock to the British system was Prussia's great success, the unfitness of the British troops in the Boer War, and the First World War, that these making the people warriors in the age of conscription, if you like, was an important... I don't know if in your history you deal with warfare as being the way to welfare, and what that tells us might be recreated in the future in a more dangerous world with nationalism arising in all sorts of places. My other point is really also to link in with Tony's about the role of local government. If one of the big problems is to get people to pay more taxes willingly, then you surely need systems that enable them to see that their taxes are spent on things they value highly. And one way of doing that is not to have central government big programs, but to have programs that are more based locally, so that with fashionable devolution of local taxation of fiscal resources, you would be able to get in people's minds a link between what they were paying in taxes and what they got back from the welfare state.
Okay, just hold on a second, Andrew, before we go to war and devolution. If you take the microphone to the chap at the back in the blue shirt with the blue, that's you, and then the next one, guy in the middle here. So, right, John, Andrew.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think the history of the welfare state is really complex. And I think that one of the most important sources of its development was war, and so that many of the reasons why it was thought important to develop welfare programs had nothing to do with traditional sort of moral case for helping the poor. There were some very strong functional reasons for doing it, and certainly the welfare state which we actually got was shaped enormously by the experience of the World War. So we can't really separate it from that. And on devolution too, yes, I think one of the biggest. I mean, the UK is not like many other European countries in being. We still remain so centralised. And what's happening with education, with the creation of the academies, which means actually that, again, another whole function of local government has been stripped away and handed over. The schools now become accountable to the Department of Education, which no one ever imagined had the capacity or the ability to manage that. And so no doubt there's going to be a whole, well, they've already started, there's going to be a whole string of problems about that process. So I think that getting the level of responsibility right and getting the democratic accountability and the people feeling that they're getting direct value for their taxes at a local level, I mean, that is one of the ways forward which in many other countries is done very successfully.
Okay, and at the back, yeah.
Just picking up on that idea that you're talking about of the fragmentation of society and how that's leading to what you could almost categorise as a general lack of support or belief in the foundational benefits of a welfare state. Looking at what a future welfare state may possibly look like if it is to survive, an increasing concept that is broadly coming into the mainstream is that of a universal basic income, which would see direct transfers to everyone within society. So instead of having the increasing situation that we do now of, let's say, poor doors in private developments that are required to have affordable housing, and of no general interactions with the welfare state, if you're fortunate enough to be able to rely solely on the private sector through private health insurance or through private education, is that a way of bringing back that community cohesiveness that you talked about in terms of having to counteract the increasing fragmentation and individualization of society currently? And is that a way that a future welfare state could survive and could look like into the future?
You touch on minimum, sort of national minimum incomes, don't you?
Yeah. I think basic income is a very interesting idea. I mean, there are quite a lot of problems with it and about how you'd introduce it. But I think one of its attractions is precisely that it removes the discriminatory aspect and the stigmatizing aspect of so much of our current welfare programs. The problem is that it's a very difficult political sell if it's some of its advocates want an unconditional basic income to be paid to every citizen, and there are ways you can work that out, but it would require people to pay much higher marginal rates of tax on the incomes they received above their basic income. Now, that's not impossible to imagine, but the political drawback is that people would immediately say, well, I'm not paying high marginal rates of taxation so that people can go windsurfing, which of course was Van Parijs's famous. Van Parijs said, I have no problem about people going windsurfing. He said, I want to live in a society where everybody has free choice, and it doesn't matter to me if people just lie in bed all day and He said that the majority will work and so forth. I think one, but that's the problem. And the same issue came up with the debate on capital grants which Julian Legrand and Bruce Ackerman and others were very closely identified with in the late 90s. Again, the issue is conditionality. But actually, Tony Atkinson has put forward a really interesting proposal, which is a form of basic income, but where there would be some conditionality. It would be that people would have to participate in certain work. They would have to do certain things. So it could be unpaid work, but it would be they would have to volunteer in some way, or they would have to show that they had childcare responsibilities or elderly relative responsibilities or whatever, in order to be drawing the basic income. So there would be a citizenship obligation. But it seems to me that the strength of the idea is that, because in one way, universal basic income is the original idea of the welfare state. That's the original idea. And the question is always, has always been throughout the history of the welfare state, how generous can the welfare state be? And how can we set up the funding of it in ways that people will be prepared to pay taxes? So how much taxes are people prepared to pay in return for living in a solidaristic, socially cohesive society? And there are different answers across the different welfare states that we have. But I certainly think that the idea of universal basic income, if nothing else, the idea of it as a thought experiment of actually thinking, how do we renew the commitment we have to creating and developing our welfare state, I think it's a very interesting idea.
I mean, you mentioned Beveridge earlier, and then by implication now. I mean, the sort of welfare system that is embedded in the welfare state, certainly as we know it in Britain, is a very, very, very much bigger thing than Beveridge envisaged. Yeah. Didn't he? His welfare state was unquestionably absolutely bare minimum, tide you over the difficult times, just sort of survival kind of welfare state. So, isn't one of the problems, well, a challenge that we've moved, possibly, you know, public assent, have moved from that idea of a very basic minimum underpinning through to something which has elements of human rights behind it, in the sense that people have a right to certain standards, certain expectations, and that particularly those who are vulnerable definitely need the state to step in to do that. Which is a very long way from Beveridge, and I mean, I know the whole country is richer since then, but it is a long way from what Beveridge had in mind, isn't it?
Yes, it is a long way from Beveridge, and it does, you know, undeniably it creates problems. I mean, this recent row over disability payments. I mean, I forget the precise figures now, but the increase when they were first introduced, costing around 3 billion, and then over about 10, 15 years, the cost has increased to 16 billion. And the actual cuts which George Osborne wanted to impose, which caused Ian Duncan Smith to flip and to leave the cabinet, would only have smoothed the rise. It wasn't actually going to reduce the total very much, and that's one of the reason why that. And now you can look at it two ways. I mean, there are those who say, well, there obviously must be a huge amount of waste and inefficiency here, and people are claiming benefits to which they're not entitled. And Charles Moore in the Daily Telegraph started talking about people were claiming that if they needed a bed in order to sit down to put their socks on, that they could claim that under the disability benefit. So you had those sorts of stories in the press about how these claims were all bogus. The other argument, of course, is that until that entitlement was given, until it was recognised as a social right, actually the extent of the discrimination against disabled people hadn't been understood.
Yeah.
And now, you know, where the truth lies. I mean, that's what, of course, politics is about, and what citizens have to make. And we need, you know, a great deal more information before it's possible to come to a judgment. But you're absolutely right. That's the thing about entitlements. Once entitlements are granted, once they're seen as part of democratic citizenship, once they're part of the social contract, then it's very difficult to take them away. And politicians that want to take them away, they often run into great difficulties, and that's when you hear, I mean, when you get U-turns and the
resignations.
Yeah.
Okay, in the front, in the middle. You're on.
I was just wondering whether you could highlight the specific challenges that types of welfare state will be facing, differentiating especially between the Bismarck model and the Beveridge model. And also thinking that whether the Bismarck model is gradually moving towards a more residual and Beveridge model, in the sense, you know, the retrenchment, the recalibration, and the activation policies that have gone on in the 1990s and 2000s, does this mark the shift from, I mean, the end of the Bismarck model towards a more Beveridge model everywhere? You see what I mean? And also, on the minimum income, since the gentleman raised it, could this give, as a political economy question mainly, could this give a sort of legitimation for retrenchment in other welfare services, the introduction of minimum income?
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. Well, certainly there are these trends towards making the welfare state residual, and all the other welfare state models are finding, again, this same sort of pressure of costs and rising entitlements and to some extent tax resistance. It's not as acute, though, as in the Anglo-American world. And I somewhat doubt that it will actually go as far as it. And even in the Anglo-Saxon world, as I've said, there are very strong forces fighting back and resisting the residualization. I think the problem with the, I think particularly with the Bismarck model, is that that is a very, you know, it is a very top-down model, and it's based upon certain assumptions about the family and family structure, which are increasingly outmoded in contemporary societies. So the whereas the Nordic model is also has its challenges. I mean, we shouldn't think that the Nordic countries are just paradises on earth. They have, of course, a very significant immigration problem at the present time. And that, of course, is one. The more generous your welfare state, the more that people may want to protect it against newcomers. So I think all the welfare state models have these problems, but the outcomes are then determined by the internal politics and whether the trade-offs that have been established, often over long periods, can still be defended. And I think the evidence, even in this period of austerity and retrenchment, is that so far they have. But I agree with you that it's the Bismarck model, which is the one which is perhaps most under threat, partly because of the other of the very severe austerity policies which the ordo-liberal ideas have pushed forward. I mean, much more stringent austerity policies than have been applied, for instance, in the UK. And on the just on the basic income point, yes, I mean, I think that's the other problem about basic income. I mean, if it was one of the origins of the basic income idea, not the only origin, but one of them was Milton Friedman and negative income tax. And certainly Milton Friedman proposed negative income tax as a way of actually dismantling all welfare spending, as well as, you know, spending on education, health, and I mean, he saw it as and then, you know, every individual would be on their own in the in the market, but they'd get some top up through the through the tax system, but then there'd be no state-run services at all. But that's why I said at the end, really, that the I think if a move towards a basic income, or certainly a conditional basic income, made sense and was politically feasible, it would have to be accompanied still by other measures, because housing is a crucial issue which would be very difficult for a universal basic income to solve, because housing costs are such a large part of welfare payments, and housing costs vary, as we know, enormously between different parts of a country. And similarly, the whole question of full employment and of jobs, of having sufficient jobs, and also of having sufficiently well-paid jobs, and therefore having workers organised in ways that they can actually defend their interests in a more globalised economy. All of those things, a universal basic income on its own could open the door for a residualisation of the welfare state. So it would have to be seen as part of a package.
Presumably Friedman would have expected people to move around, wouldn't he?
He would,
so there
would have
been no housing subsidies.
Yes. Right. No housing subsidies at all, no.
Yeah. Right.
Hello.
I
was just wondering if you take away... two things, basically. If you take away, police, fire and military, if you just take that away, how much of the spending that is... the welfare state is part of GDP as a percentage, and how that's changed over time, if you know that, like whether now we're spending a vastly bigger percentage of GDP than we used to, or whether that's fluctuated, and the trajectory of that, basically. And then also the question, can the welfare state survive, obviously implies within it that it's in a state of erosion, and the trajectory is for it to die. That's implied within the question, that the trajectory is already set, and we would have to then turn the bull's head, as it were. But out of all the different things that we've talked about, if that is the underlying implication and the underlying opinion, what is the one biggest factor that is eroding it so severely? Is it simply what we would be led to believe that is just pure affordability, or would you have a different opinion of what the one biggest cause of the erosion of the welfare state would be?
Okay. On the trajectory, you're right. It has fluctuated, although it shows it goes back to George's point, really. I mean, the really big increases were in wartime. The really big, and then it settles down to a plateau. The figures which are often quoted for the level of spending in 1975, say, or in 2009-10 are a bit are not quite right, because in 2009 it goes up to the state spending as a whole goes up to around 48-49% of GDP, but that's because there's been a 7-8% drop in output, and so it's actually so the spending stayed the same, but there's a smaller economy, and then the issue is, you know, so if to maintain it at its previous level, the government would either have had to raise taxes or increase its borrowing and so on. But I think the pattern for just for well for all the things that come under welfare spending, including education, health, and so on, there's been a slight tendency to move secular tendency for increase, but not of any overall. That's partly because some other categories like defence have slightly reduced, particularly after the Cold War, but the overall pattern in the UK certainly has been that public spending has been remarkably stable as a proportion of GDP since the end of the Second World War, and George Osborne's latest plans also only take it back to the historical average and don't take it way below that, down to 35%.
So it's not set to sort of burgeon and explode, no, like we're kind of led to believe.
It's not. But that's partly because governments take action. But to go to the second part of your question, I mean, I think it is affordability. This is a very rich country, as are all the other advanced democracies, and we could choose to spend more on welfare. But we'd have to choose to spend to pay more in taxes. So it's really it's the question of what trade-off the citizens of a country want. But it's this problem of them wanting the best possible services, but not actually being willing to pay the taxes for them. It's a very human failing. We all of us have this in our lives.
And vote for other people to pay. That's the other thing.
Well, that's the other thing. Yes, if only there were these magic pots that could be. And of course, politicians are often adept at suggesting there is a magic pot which could be. And indeed, there are some pots which could be drawn on more than they are being at the moment. But the basic thing about the welfare state, it seems to me, is that this is about the nature of our democracy, and that it is there is an underlying social contract, and we are pooling risks across the life cycle, and so the basic judgment every citizen makes is what am I prepared to pay for that, and how much in taxes am I prepared to pay for that, and because the main burden has to lie on all the citizens who are in work and paying taxes.
Okay,
this is probably a bit of a weird question because I'm an interloper here, but blockchain technology is clearly potentially able to provide a sort of ultimate voucherization of welfare benefits. Is there any work being done on blockchain as a means for delivering welfare?
You're going to have to. For nobody else in the audience, but
well, that's
me,
why it's probably weird
to explain it to me. No, it's not weird, but just give me a sense of what blockchain is.
So blockchain technology is what lies behind Bitcoin, but more importantly, it allows autonomous contracts between anonymous individuals. So you could hypothecate your welfare. Just thinking about it now, your welfare to be spent on smoking cessation or on exercise or on housing and have that completely assured that that money was being spent that way, which would solve the problem, perhaps, of some people saying, well, why would my taxes rise to enable people to go windsurfing? I'm not advocating this. The question was, is any work being done on this? Because it seems to me that it's very likely that the right wing in the States are doing this. Yeah. And it's probably also the case that there are communitarian versions of blockchain that would reinforce solidarity.
Okay.
Andrew. Yes, I mean, I don't know a great deal, but I know there is work going on in the US amongst libertarian groups about these kinds of possibilities. I mean, in the UK, I don't know whether anyone is doing this, but it goes. I mean, there has been a long debate in the UK about hypothecation. The Treasury has always resisted hypothecation because it much prefers to have all taxes paid into one pot. And then, of course, but that of course is the instinct of centralised government. What is interesting is occasionally hypothecation has been tried in a very limited way, but it is also possible without going to the making full use of this new technology. It would be possible to try and hypothecate for certain services. The risk of doing that is that what the opinion poll evidence shows from British Social Attitudes and so on is that there has been quite a marked shift. As I briefly mentioned, that there's been a hardening of attitudes to the poor and to people dependent on welfare benefits, whereas there has still been very strong support for spending on education and health. So you'd probably be able to get hypothecated taxation. You know, people prepared to pay more if it could be shown definitely that the money was going to be spent on the National Health Service. But if you wanted to, for spending on some of the income support benefits, that might be very much harder. And so the problem for your welfare state is what if you allow that political dynamic to develop, I suppose it's interesting because I suppose you could say, well, it might be a way where people would be prepared to pay a lot more in tax if they could be sure what the money was being spent on. It's just then there are some groups you would worry about in a solidaristic society as to whether anyone would put them on their list to receive.
And would people be geographically specific about what they wanted to spend money soon? I want to spend my taxes only in London. I want to spend them only in Scotland. That would itself have a major redistribution effect.
The real thing about blockchain is it will define how people spend their welfare benefits.
Yes.
It will be in that sense, it will be a
bancharisation. Okay.
Or it could be.
Okay, very good.
My question.
Then the woman, then we probably need to stop. Yeah.
The question follows nicely from that. I represent disabled people in Camden and elderly, but I speak for myself today. I have a social policy degree from LSE, and I've been refused PIP migration to personal independence payment on a technicality. So if I can't fill out the forms with a postgraduate education, it says something. This isn't so much about the policy, it's about the administration, and it seems unjust to reduce spending on technicalities. And lastly, it wasn't Richard Titmus right to say that there's a moral argument is the gift relationship.
Yeah.
So maladministration as a way of reducing public spending in Richard Titmus.
Yes. Well, I absolutely agree. I mean, I think the I think the difficulty with these... I think the whole way that disability benefits have been approached, I mean, shows the... It's exactly that way of administering welfare, which has often brought the welfare state into disrepute. And it's the... It's often seemed that the welfare state, the way it's administered in some areas, that it's not actually there to help the people for whom it was set up to do. And that does then create... It seems to me that then it loses support for the welfare state, but it also creates a mood elsewhere amongst other citizens that actually... these services are not worth supporting, and I think the I think the one of the big problems, I mean, one of the great promises of the welfare state was its promise of generosity, which was both a generosity in resources, but also a generosity of spirit. And sometimes the welfare state doesn't feel generous in either of those two senses. And that's very much Titmuss's point, that, I mean, Titmuss wasn't Bismarck, and I think it's safe to say.
Chamberlain.
And Titmuss was very much thought that the moral claim was the one on which welfare should be based. But I think, I mean, welfare, it is more complex, and the broad base support that the welfare state has is not just, has never been entirely just the moral case. It's also been other aspects as well.
Okay, in the middle there. Yes.
Yeah, you mentioned previously the impact of migration on the welfare state, and it would be interesting to hear something more specific about that, especially because in my migration course, we have read various reports stating that actually the burden of migration is minimal on welfare state because they contribute more in taxes than they take in pensions or some other benefits.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. Well, I think there's a lot of evidence to that effect, but of course that's not how migrants are perceived by a large number of citizens, and that's the problem, that there is so much misinformation around the whole migration issue, as well as, though, also some very real concerns and anxieties where there are very large concentrations of migrants, and then there are implications for schools and other public services. I think the migration issue is one of the most difficult ones for the welfare state, because it goes to the heart of this idea that the welfare states were set up as national national benefits, so these are national communities, and this is the welfare state, and the welfare benefits are what you get for belonging to a particular national community, and you pay your taxes in and you get these benefits back. And that's... So then you get this resentment against people coming in and all the talk about benefit tourists and so on, and the idea that people are getting something for nothing, and they're getting benefits but they haven't paid in. And they're taking our jobs, and they're taking our houses, and they're taking our schools, and so forth. And that is very strong. These are very strong political trends across Europe. And of course, the problems become. I mean, and that's even affects some of the free movement of labour within the EU. But of course, is even more toxic when it comes to the movement of migrants from and refugees from the Middle East or from Africa or so on, and I think it's one of the hardest political problems, because how do you, the one time, on the one hand, advocate more generous benefits for your own citizens, but are not willing to extend them, or not want to put up the barriers to people from much poorer societies coming to participate in those in those benefits. But the that's where the politics of the welfare state and the protectionist aspect of welfare states comes to the fore. And I don't have a good answer really for this, except to say that the it seems to me that the lack of welfare states in so many other parts of the world won't actually be remedied by dismantling the welfare states which we already have, and that but that what we have to find ways of doing is spreading wealth and opportunity around the whole world, and that the and there are signs that the economies which are rapidly growing in other parts of the world at the moment, that gradually they are beginning to address the issue of developing their own welfare states. And I think that, I mean, in any sort of long historical view, that's the only way we can go, that the spreading of jobs and opportunity and wealth to all countries in the world, and ultimately democracies and welfare states. But we have this very difficult political problem of how we manage the tensions of if migration is too high for existing political, the political communities, particularly the political communities of Europe and the United States and Japan and the other advanced democracies. And all of them do impose restrictions on entry. No one has open borders. I mean, there are open borders within parts of the EU, but that's a different question. The real open borders issue is across the whole world. So I think it's a huge issue. But like a lot of these issues, it depends on a gradual process of political education and acceptance of higher migration flows, as well as activity to help other countries develop.
Okay, it is 8 o'clock, so I'll make the question very short, and okay. If Andrew, the answer short, then we finish in 2 minutes. Okay.
Okay. Yeah, I'd like just to comment about the role that you think that the Cold War play in the consolidation of the welfare state. If you think that it was like a way of preventing Western Europe from the communist temptation, and if so, to what extent the lack of a so strongly polarized world today is a threat to the welfare state. Thank you.
Right. Well, it clearly played a big role, particularly in Europe, and of course it allowed people that wanted to develop a world. It gave them a whole set of very good arguments and a lot of force behind them, and certainly the need to and partly the whole reconstruction program of Europe after 1945 and the generosity of it was motivated by the fear of what would happen if countries were lost to the West and were absorbed into the Soviet bloc. So I do think it was important. It wasn't the only factor. There were obviously lots of domestic considerations as well. But it was one of the things, and the whole strengthening of organized labor at the same time, which actually produced a very sort of benign circle of factors which promoted prosperity, full employment, low inflation, high living standards, and high welfare spending, so that the it worked very well. Now, take that away. Well, I mean, well, we have the EU, so the and actually the there is actually the habit of interdependence has become much more deeply embedded since the Cold War period. And the EU is one of the examples of that. Of course, there are proposals for countries to leave the EU and for the dismantling of some of this interdependence. That doesn't seem to me a very sensible idea. And it wouldn't... I think one of the things I worry about most is that... it's very easy at any particular historical time you're living to take for granted what you have. And populations have always done this historically, and it's understandable why they do so. But an awareness of history is also an awareness of how fragile political systems are, how transient they can be, and how... it's important to make sure that the things which promote interdependence and cooperation are maintained. So, yes, I'd hope we don't need some sort of external enemy to actually be reminded of that lesson, because there are negatives about about the Cold War. It was one of the unintended consequences that it helped to strengthen the welfare state. It did a lot of other things.
Okay, we must finish. I was... this is a book in a series. I hadn't seen this before. And for the gentleman who asked whether this title was a bit sort of gloomy, if I tell you one or two of the other titles in this series called Global Futures is... Will the Middle East implode? Can financial markets be controlled? Is the American century over? And is the EU doomed? So actually, Andrew's essay, I think, is actually quite an optimistic one, because there is the implication in there. It is an essay. It's nicely read. It's nice to read. So I would encourage, if you want to buy a copy and get Andrew, if you wanted Andrew to sign it. I'd like to thank Andrew for not only an elegant talk, but also answering all these questions this evening. I'm sure you can come up at the end and ask them more if you want. And on a personal note, I'd just like to thank Martin Rogers, who's worked with us at British Government for 4 years now, and who's arranged many of these kind of events and helpfully done everything, really. So thank you, Martin. And other than that, thank you all for coming, and thank you, Andrew, and good evening.